You guys, welcome back to my Flickers of Fear show, and it's still March, so we're talking about monsters. It's Monster March. That's the theme for the movie reviews this month, and this is a movie that I feel like everybody had seen but me, and so I thought it was probably time to get around to seeing it, even though it's technically not really a horror movie. It's more like fantasy romance, but with some sci-fi and horror elements. But you know, I kind of like genre crossers like that. And as I said, it's, you know, it was a movie by Guillermo del Toro, who I'm a big fan of, and I don't know why it took me so fucking long to see this movie, because I had really been jazzed about seeing it, and for whatever reason, I just never got around to it. This is The Shape of Water from 2017. Now, as I said, I kind of feel like everybody's probably seen this by now. It won Best Picture in the 2018 Oscars, was nominated for, I believe Guillermo del Toro won Best Director as well. I think it won 4 Oscars, and was nominated for fuck tons of other awards, Golden Globes and all this other stuff. So it got like tons and tons of awards and tons of accolades. Seems to be pretty critically, almost universally beloved. Although I think there is kind of like maybe a small contingent of people that didn't really dig it, but I have to say that I don't know why it took me so long to watch this, because this was, I mean, it was just like a beautiful movie, like all around. And I'm not just talking about a beautiful looking movie, which it certainly was that, but I mean, just like the whole kind of theme of it, the whole idea behind it was just like a really beautiful idea. I think one of the things that I really like the most about Guillermo del Toro as a filmmaker is that I really like that he seems just so like not cynical. He's, you know, and I don't necessarily want to say he's a romantic, because that's kind of sounds dismissive, but I mean it in the sense that he really does not seem to have a cynical bone in his body. His movies are very heartfelt and they're very genuine, and he seems like not afraid of talking about love and emotion like in old-fashioned sort of fairy tale sort of contexts, where, you know, maybe some people might say it was too corny or something like that. And he has actually said things to that effect when he's been interviewing. He's like, you know, people are just so cynical nowadays, and it's like they don't really want to talk about, you know, you talk about these kind of things like in this movie, these love stories and stuff, and everybody is just, you know, shitting on it because there's like, oh, it's corny or whatever. So I admire his kind of balls in coming out and being like, no, it's not corny, you know, and just like letting it all hang out there and being very genuine about it. And I can't really think of another filmmaker, at least one, you know, that's as widely known as he is, that's operating in that same kind of thing. I mean, his love of cinema really like oozes from every frame of every single movie of his that I've seen. So the fact that he made this movie, which is essentially, you know, it's not an original story. It's, you know, an update or kind of an inversion, I guess, of Beauty and the Beast. But really, it's kind of an update of Creature from the Black Lagoon, but sort of a takeoff of that. So if you haven't seen it, this will have some spoilers, because I feel like even though this movie was, you know, came out 4 years ago, something like that, but I do kind of feel like it was such a big cultural thing and it won Best Picture. So I feel like even people that haven't seen it probably know like what happens in it, or kind of knows what happens at the end. So I'm not really all that worried about spoiling it, because I feel like this was a pretty widely seen film at the time, and, you know, even nowadays. So the story behind this, if you don't know, it's actually set in 1962 in Baltimore. I had actually didn't know, I mean, pretty much the only thing I knew going into this movie was kind of like a weird, I don't want to say weird, like, because again, that sounds, you know, derogatory, and I don't mean it in that sense. But, you know, obviously the big thing everybody took away from this is like, oh, a human woman falls in love with a fish man, essentially. You know, and yes, they do have sex with each other, and maybe some people were weirded out by that. But honestly, watching the movie, one, it doesn't, what, you know, when you say like human woman falling in love with a fish man and having sex with a fish man, like it sounds a lot weirder than it actually comes across in the movie. And the movie isn't just about that. It has like a bunch of other stuff going on, which, as I said, I didn't realize, you know, just from a cursory like read about it that it was a period piece and that it was set during the Cold War. So that kind of brought like a different sort of, you know, sensibility to it, I guess. And it is done very much like a fairy tale, but it does have a lot of realistic stuff in it. And I think that he did that. I think he wanted to set it during this particular time period, and I'll get into probably why he did that in a bit. But in a lot of ways, like a lot of filmmakers do this, a lot of writers do this, where you kind of set something back in the past because you're trying to say something about, you know, the present day, but people will be more receptive to it, I guess, like if, you know, it's if it's couched in other terms, you know, where it's like, that was a long time ago, and maybe people watching the movie now weren't alive back then, so we're just kind of, like, doing that. So I kind of feel like that's how he did that, but I think it was, like, a really good time to set it in. So it's set in 1962 in Baltimore, and we're following a woman named Eliza, and she is a mute woman. She was an orphan, they say at some point in the film. She was found, like, by the side of a river or something like that, like, as a baby, and it looked like she had been abused. There are these scars on the side of her neck, which is presumably what made her unable to talk. So she works as a cleaner at this sort of kind of top secret, like, government research facility type thing. So she works there. Her best friend there is played by Octavia Spencer. And she kind of, like, you know, Octavia Spencer's character kind of translates for her and just kind of, like, sticks up for her. She says they've known each other for a very long time. So that's, she has that friend, you know, and then also her neighbor, she lives kind of in this apartment by herself over an old movie theater, which seems like it's not doing all that well. And her next door neighbor is this older man named Giles, who was an advertising executive, but has been having trouble finding work for a lot of reasons, but one of the main reasons being that he is like an illustrator in the sense that he paints things by hand, and a lot of the advertising in 1962 was going more toward like photographic representation, so he's not really getting a lot of work anymore. He's also a closeted gay man, and as I said, he's middle-aged, he's getting a little bit older, and so it's kind of hard for him to, like, sort of fit in 1962. He feels like a little bit of an outcast. And indeed, that seems to be, like, the main theme of the film. Everybody in this, really, is some kind of outcast. You know, you have the main character, Eliza, who is an orphan and she's mute. You also have her friend, who's played by Octavia Spencer, who's a black woman in 1962. Baltimore, kind of like a working class black woman. You know, you have Giles, who is, you know, a closeted gay man, and also who seems to be, and he even says this at some point, he seems to be like really, really into old stuff, like old musicals and old style of art and things like that. But then in some ways, he's kind of like really likes old things, but he's really kind of like ahead of his time as well. So he's kind of like a man out of time. So again, like misfits. So that's why when this secret government agency that that Eliza works at, when they bring in this sea creature, essentially, which they just call the Asset, they bring it in there and keep it in a tank. They apparently found it, you know, in the Amazon, and they said that the locals worshipped it as a god, and they basically just captured it, and they want to figure out if there's some way that they can use it to get, you know, a leg up on the Soviets, because, as I said, this is the Cold War. So Michael Shannon plays Colonel Strickland, who is the guy that caught the Asset, you know, or amphibian man, if you want to call him that, who's played by Doug Jones, by the way, who Doug Jones plays pretty much every... Anytime you see a Guillermo del Toro movie with a creature in it, then it's probably Doug Jones in there. And I really have to, I love, love, love the amphibian man design of this. Obviously very influenced by Creature from the Black Lagoon, which, as I said, there was numerous interviews with Guillermo del Toro at the time this movie came out. And he said the idea for this movie came from seeing Creature from the Black Lagoon when he was 6 years old and thinking that the Gill Man and the female lead were going to end up together, like it was going to be a love story, and then being, because he was a little kid, and he was kind of like bummed out when that didn't happen. So You know what I mean? Because, you know, the Gill Man was kind of like a cool, you know, he was a humanoid figure, and, you know, and he just kind of got shot by the people, and that was, you know, he was kind of wanting to invert the universal monster thing, even though some of the universal monster films and some of the other monster films of like the 1930s and stuff, you know, King Kong, obviously, or, you know, the original Frankenstein, did have some kind of like sympathy for the monster. A lot of the movies, and this kind of went through the 50s and stuff as well. I mean, anything that looked like a monster was a monster and just like pretty much had to be destroyed. And he kind of wanted to invert that a little bit. So Michael Shannon, his character, Colonel Strickland, who is just the fucking worst. I mean, he's like a villain. But I don't know. I kind of feel like one of the main criticisms people have with this, they thought that his character was too one-dimensional or he's too like overtly villainous. I didn't really find that. And one kind of interesting thing that Guillermo del Toro said about his character, and he said that him and Michael Shannon had talked about this, was that he's like, at least in the first part of the movie, had this movie come out in the 1950s, for example, Colonel Strickland would have been seen kind of like as a good guy, even though, you know, he's a bit sadistic, obviously, but if this had been like a traditional monster movie where the amphibian man was actually a monster, then Colonel Strickland would have been the hero. He said, you know, this kind of square-jawed, you know, white dude that was coming in and like figuring everything out, and he's the one that's gonna have to like destroy the monster. So he kind of wanted to like subvert that 50s trope a little bit as well. But the interesting thing about Michael Shannon's character is that even though he's obviously the villain and he's very hateable, and you know, I feel like Michael Shannon, poor Michael Shannon, I love Michael Shannon so much, by the way, but I feel like he always plays parts like this, I guess just because of how he looks. But he always kind of plays, he doesn't always play psychos, but he's really, really good at it, which, like I said, I guess that's kind of why. But he's really good in this, I like him a lot. But, you know, even though as happy as you are when you see him get his just desserts at the end, you know, because he was such an asshole like throughout the whole entire movie and was just kind of like throwing his dick around everywhere, you know, metaphorically, it was the movie does actually take pains to show a little bit of not so much a human side, but kind of shows why he is the way he is. And showing that he's not really a happy person either. It's like he has what on the surface, particularly in, you know, the 50s and early 1960s in America, would have seemed like the ideal, you know, life. He's got like the classic nuclear family. He's got a beautiful wife and two kids, and he has like a really nice house, and he buys a new Cadillac, and all, and he has a good job and stuff like that. But you can tell that he's not fulfilled by that. And as the movie goes on, you know, as he gets more and more villainous, you learn that he's a little bit of a victim too, because he's never kind of like lived up to what he thought he should be able to live up to. And he's got other guys over him that will basically, well, if you fuck up, then you're out on your ass. You know what I mean? So he doesn't really have a lot of power either. And it really does seem like he's having a hard time dealing with that eventuality, P particularly in his interactions with like the five-star general that's like, you know, that outranks him. And, you know, him thinking that all he has to do, he just has to like do all this stuff and prove himself, and then he'll be like top dog. But that's not how that works out. So the fact that it's not working out just like makes him angrier and angrier. But he does, like, at the very end, does seem to realize, you know, would have like a little bit of a come to Jesus moment, where he recognizes the humanity and actually, in some ways, the sort of like superiority. I don't know if I want to use that word, but he recognizes, you know, the amphibian man actually having, you know, powers and stuff like that, and actually being kind of godlike, you know, and so he does recognize that at the end, like before he gets killed. Spoiler alert. So essentially, what happens in the movie? Eliza, because she's like a cleaner and she's mute, and so she sort of like fades into the background. So she's kind of like allowed to go a lot of places in this facility because no one really notices her. No one really notices any of the cleaners, really. So she ends up cleaning this one place where the amphibian man is being kept, because during Colonel Strickland, Michael Shannon's, one of his little sessions where he just keeps like shocking the thing, just seemingly to kind of keep it in line and like show that he's the boss or whatever. And Amphibian Man gets mad and bites off two of his fingers, and there's blood everywhere. So she has to go in there and kind of like clean up the lab. Now, she immediately develops an affinity with this Amphibian Man. And interestingly, even though everybody else essentially sees this creature as a monster, she, because he can't talk, but because he's like humanoid, he seems to respond to her and she seems to respond to him as, like I said, they have like an affinity with one another. Like she recognizes his otherness and as like mirroring her own otherness. So over time, she starts like bringing him eggs and she like plays music for him. And so they develop this like, you know, deep kind of relationship with one another. She teaches him sign language so he can communicate with her and other things like that. So then she finds out or like overhears that at some point they're like, okay, we don't really think that this is going to be any help to us in our, you know, fight with the Russians or whatever. So we're going to vivisect him to see what we can get out of this. And then we'll just like throw him away. So she finds out about that. She flips out and she said, we have to get him the fuck out of here. So she tries to, there's a great scene where she tries to, convince Giles to like help her, and he doesn't want to at first because he's like, look, we're nobodies, we're nothing, we're like at the bottom of the fucking barrel, what can we do? We can't help anybody, we can't help ourselves. It's like, why even bother? But she actually does bring him around to like helping her. She's like, look, how can you call yourself a human if you are not willing to help out? It's like, he's intelligent, you know, he has just as much right as the rest of us, and it's like something terrible is going to happen to him if you don't do something. So he does actually end up helping her. And they also get help from this scientist that works there who is actually, you don't know this until a little bit later, but he's actually like a Soviet like spy. But he's also a scientist, and he seems like he's really not happy with like either fucking side, because he does not want to kill the amphibian man, because he's like, look, there's so much we could learn from this. This is a new species. It seems intelligent. It seems to have emotions, and it seems to like respond to, you know, people. And you know, the top brass and shit, like, they're like, we don't want to hear that. Like, fucking, we don't want to hear that crap. So you know, they're like, we're just gonna kill him. Just forget about it. So he actually does end up helping them as well. So they actually do, she actually does manage to bust Amphibian Man out, and she keeps him in her bathtub, and she's going to release him like back out into the sea, like when the rains make the canal like high enough that it goes back out to the ocean. So she's like made her plan to do that. At some point, as mentioned, and like I said, probably the biggest thing that everybody talked about in this movie, even though, yes, it's in the movie, but it's not really the point of the movie. But yeah, she does actually end up having sex with the fish man, and there is a very funny scene where she explains to her friend how it was possible, like, I guess, like, how a cloaca works. So there was that whole thing, too. But honestly, I know that it's very, like, giggly and tee-hee and everything like that, but I do kind of like that this is, like I said, essentially like a Beauty and the Beast story, but it's not like a Disney-fied, like, you know, oh, lovey-dovey, everything like that. Like, they're in love, but there's also, like, a sexual component. So it's much more, like, realistic in that sense. And I like, too, that one of the first things they show before she even meets the fish man is her having, like, a normal sexual drive. Like, they show her, like, masturbating in her bathtub and things like that. So they're just showing that as, like, just a normal part of life. It's not, you know, seen as anything like seedy or anything like that. She's just like a normal woman with like normal sexual needs. And I thought that that was kind of cool that they sort of addressed it like that. So that's what I mean when I say, yes, you can like make jokes about having sex with a fish man, but it sounds weird when you say it. But when you see it in the movie, or at least when I saw it in the movie, it didn't strike me as particularly bizarre or particularly gross or particularly anything like that, because I mean, and you have to say, too, that, like, the makeup that they did on Doug Jones, You know, yes, he looks like the creature from the Black Lagoon, essentially. I really like the way they did the eyes. It's almost all like practical effects, by the way. But, you know, he still looks humanoid. So, you know, it's not like crazy to think that somebody would be into that. I mean, I guess it's like less weird nowadays because, you know, people like furries and all that kind of stuff. So it's not really that strange. I didn't really like think of it as that strange. But yeah, so that was one thing that I kind of liked about it. So as I mentioned, you know, there's a whole thing toward the end with the Soviet scientist helping them out, and then Michael Shannon finding out, because at first, like, he thinks that it was this big, like, fucking crack spy team that came in there and stole the asset, and at first he kind of, like, refuses to believe that it was just, like, a cleaning lady, you know what I mean, and a couple of her friends, who helped, who busted this, this fish man out, but, you know, so there's a thing, like, a pursuit toward the end where he's, you know, his ass is on the line too, so he's like, I have to find the fish man, within, so he has to, like, go track it down. He just kind of gets crazier and crazier as it goes on, and more murderous and villainous, because he's, again, you know, has realized that he doesn't have as much power over the situation as he thought he did, you know, so there's that whole thing too. And, again, toward the end, it kind of goes in a direction sort of like end of Creatures in Black Lagoon, because the fishman does get shot, but it turns out that the, you know, the natives in the Amazon who were worshiping this creature as a god were actually not too far off, because he actually does have sort of, like, healing powers. And, so, like I said, Michael Shannon, before he actually gets killed by the creature, and rightfully so, I have to say, does actually acknowledge, you know, he says, you are a god, and then he gets killed. Now, let's kind of talk about, and I know that someone was probably going to ask me about this. I had remembered, okay, so when I started watching this movie, and there's the scene in Giles's apartment, and he's got a bunch of cats, and I was just like, uh-oh, I think I remember somebody saying something about the fish man eating a cat. And I was just kind of like, do I want to keep watching? This is really going to upset me, because you guys know how I am about cats. And then I was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I do remember that. Oh, shit. I was like, oh, man, why you got to do that? And honestly, it was in this movie, it was, he does eat one of the cats. And it was, like, actually, like, worse than it was. Because normally, like, you see it in a movie, it's, like, just rare and, you know, it's and the thing. And then sometimes they'll show, like, the aftermath. This one, he actually, like, ate the cat's head off. And I was just like, oh, my God. I was so, so upset. And honestly, I was thinking about this earlier. I was like, could I have done without that? Honestly, because it did make the monster, well, you know, he's not a monster. He did make the fish man, like, less sympathetic. But then in a way, I was kind of like, but maybe that was kind of the point, though, because he's still, even though he's capable of empathy and he's capable of emotion, and he's capable of understanding, he's still a wild animal and he didn't know any better. Like, you know, if he lived in the Amazon, presumably he ate other little animals all the time. And so he didn't understand that that was someone's pet. You know what I mean? So I'm not really sure, like, if I, because, you know, anytime they do, like, mean stuff to cats, and especially if it's kind of like this, I'm not going to say it's played for laughs in this, because it's not really. But it's not made in, it's not, like, a humongous deal. They do kind of, like, Giles does kind of make a, not a joke, but he does just make kind of an offhand comment about it. It's like, you know, yeah, I'll forgive him for, like, eating one of my cats, but it's like, you know, if that was me, I'd have been, like, really, really upset about it. He had two other ones, but still. I don't know. I didn't love seeing that, because it did look really realistic, and it was, like, really, gory and, like, upsetting. But I can see why it's in there. I don't think it was just in there as, like, a cheap, oh my god, he ate a cat. I think it was just to show, because one of the themes of it, and, you know, Eliza goes into this at some point, she's like, the reason that she feels an affinity with the fish man is because he looks at me and doesn't see me as, like, lesser or as something, like, defective or whatever the word was that she used, because she can't talk. Whereas, like, other humans would look at her like there was something wrong with her, but to him, it didn't make any difference. So he just, like, saw her the way she was. And the thing that I liked about this, too, was that she liked him the way he was. Because remember, in Beauty and the Beast, you know, she was beautiful. You know, she was kind of like a nerd or a weirdo or whatever. But he looked like a beast. But he changed into like a handsome man, like toward the end, so they could actually like get married or whatever. And in this one, there is no transformation. Like she actually kind of transforms because she goes into the water, and then it turns out those scars on her neck, you know, become gills. So it's kind of hinted that either she was kind of like amphibious the whole time, which is maybe why she was found, you know, by the side of the water, like as a baby, or he was able to make, like, take the scars, which a lot of people, you know, gave her shit about. Not really, but I mean, it was something that was like an imperfection, and made it into like a life-giving. So now she can live under the water with him. So it's like a fairy tale type of situation. So she transformed, but he didn't. And that was kind of the cool thing, is that neither one of them really changed, because she was a good person the way she was, and she accepted him the way he was, and he accepted her the way she was. And that was kind of like I said, that was sort of like the message of the movie, I guess, was that, you know, they kind of came at each other with no judgment, you know, either way. And I thought that was kind of like a cool subversion. You know what? I just thought of this, but I was watching another video about The Shape of Water. And the woman made a really good point. I wish I could remember what it was, but the woman made a really good point when she said, you know, everybody was like all flipped out about her having sex with the fish man. But she's like, now think about, though, if the main character was a man and the monster was a mermaid, because they've made a lot of movies like that. Like, look at fucking Splash from 1984. She was a mermaid, you know, she's not a human. And nobody really was grossed out by that. You know what I mean? So why would you be grossed out if it was the other way around? And I'm like, yeah, that's actually a good point. I hadn't thought of that. Because he's essentially a merman. I mean, you know, his top half doesn't look... I mean, he looks like Creature from the Black Lagoon, obviously. But he still looks like a person. He's still got, like, hands and feet and legs, and he's two-legged and everything like that. So he's still, like, humanoid. He just looks, like, kind of fishy. So it's that kind of thing. It's not that big a deal. But yeah. So anyway, I really loved this movie. I just thought it was a gorgeously shot. I loved all the colors, like especially like all the green and just all the watery stuff. And then he used like red. I was watching an interview with him, and he said he used red at particular times. Red always represented either love, like, you know, when she jumps down with him at the bottom, or he like takes her down in the water at the bottom and she has like a red coat on, or it's represented movies or cinema, because this movie does actually have a lot of homages to other films. You know, there's a lot of and old TV shows as well. So there's like a lot of like old musicals. There's a lot of you know, there's one scene where she imagines herself and the fish man like in an old like black and white musical. He was actually going to shoot it in black and white at first. I think he was kind of thinking, oh, well, maybe people would be like, it would put people at one remove, when he wanted people to, you know, really engage with it as more, slightly more realistic. So he decided not to. But there is a sequence in it that's in black and white that's supposed to be like an old, you know, movie musical, you know, like Fred Astaire or whatever. So there is a scene in there like that. But there are a lot of scenes, like people are watching, you know, old musicals on TV, like Shirley Temple and things like that. And it just has, as I said, tons and tons of movie references. You don't necessarily have to know what they all are, but I think if you do know what they are, it really kind of like enriches the experience, you know what I mean? And like he even said, he's like, he didn't want to be like postmodern. It's like, oh, you don't have to know what the references are, what movie that is, you know, that's playing within the movie to get anything. It's just that it's in there, and if you know what it is, it just kind of adds a little bit extra, or like adds a little bit more richness to the characters and everything like that. I also want to say too, interesting, I didn't actually hear about this until I was researching this movie. I hadn't heard about this at all, but I guess when this movie came out, I guess Guillermo del Toro got sued for plagiarism, because there was one guy who had written a play, I believe it was, and the play was about a cleaning lady who falls in love, well, doesn't really fall in love with, but develops like an affinity with like a dolphin, and then like helps the dolphin escape, and it, like, kind of pointed out how similar it was. It was like a big 12-page thing. It's like, look at all the similarities. But I think ultimately they determined that It wasn't like similar enough. And honestly, he's like, I never even heard of that play. So I don't really. And honestly, it's not like it was a hugely famous one, not that I know of. I hadn't really heard of it either. But I think that actually ended up not really going anywhere. So there was that. But he did get, I don't know, it's weird because, as I said, it's not a completely original story. It's like a Beauty and the Beast type story, or it's like Creature from the Black Lagoon, but where the Gill Man and the female protagonist like end up together instead of getting killed, instead of him being a monster. It's basically just like a more sympathetic reading of that. But, you know, and he didn't really make any secret about that. He doesn't make any secret about all of the influences, like all of the movies, all of the, you know, stuff that he wanted to homage when he was making this movie. So, you know, it's, again, it's kind of like, you know, most of his stuff is very fairy tale based, and this one is no different. I like too, and he did this in Devil's Backbone, and he did this in Pan's Labyrinth and things like that, where he really juxtaposes this fantastical, beautiful, kind of world with like real life horror. This one was a little more on the fantastical side, didn't have as much, but there was like some pretty gross shit in it too. 'Cause like I said, you know, Michael Shannon gets his fingers bitten off and they sew him back on, but it doesn't quite take. So as the movie goes on, like his fingers like start rotting essentially, like they start going black and he like pulls them off at the end. And this one shot toward the end where he shoots the Russian scientist, or he gets sh the Russian scientist gets shot in the face, like it goes like through the cheek, and Michael Shannon like basically like drags him around like by his face, and it's like that part just, I was just like, oh God, it was like that was fucking nasty, and it was just so that's what I mean. It has, it's just like an interesting juxtaposition of like this gorgeous fairy tale like magical world with that kind of where it's, you know, every now and then there's like a really jarring, like horror, like a gory type, or some like a really uncomfortable, like violent kind of thing. But honestly, it's really hard to pull that off, but I feel like he always does it because, as I said, Guillermo del Toro, he just seems like just a lovely human being, and he just seems so compassionate and so empathetic, and he just seems so genuine. And that really comes through in every movie that he makes, even when stuff in the movie that's happening is like horrific or, you know, or whatever. Just this humanity of his like shines through. And so I think that's why, I mean, that's why he's one of my favorite filmmakers. Even when he makes movies that I didn't think were like fantastic, you know, there's always like something worth watching. He's always worth watching. And I always like listening to him talk about his movies because his enthusiasm for them, his love for cinema is just so infectious. And I think that really, really comes out in all of his movies. And especially in this one. I think this one was probably, it seemed like one of his most personal movies and really kind of like one of his most beautiful ones. Beautiful looking and just like beautiful in its theme, I guess, of these kind of like misfits or people that are always like been thought of as other. And how they sort of like find one another, you know, and find their place in the world. And it's just like a really, really nice. Like I said, he's always been one of those people that felt like an outsider himself. So he always kind of resonated with, you know, people or, you know, monsters in movies, like people that were like grotesque or, you know, so he had a lot of sympathy for them. And I think a lot of that comes out in most of his movies and especially in this one as well. So yeah, The Shape of Water at the moment, as of this recording, it is on Hulu, which is where I watched it. I'm sure you can find it other places as well. Let me know if you've seen it or, you know, or whatever. And if you did, like what you thought about it. And that will do it for this Flickers of Fear, continuing with Monster March, and I will see you guys on the next one. Bye.